Good evening, everyone, and thank you so much for joining us for this wonderful panel. It is indeed an honor for me to be here and to chair. Special thanks to the London School of Economics IDEAS and to David Sutton for his organization. Welcome to the collapse of the Soviet Union 30 years on, transition and Soviet legacy. This event is held with LSE IDEAS in partnership with the Central and Southeastern Europe Program on the RATU Forum, a Romania-based organization partnered with LSE IDEAS that supports liberal democracy in the region. Will be a wonderful panel, very timely. I will not take up any of your time before we get to the panelists. What we'll do is I'll introduce each panelist before they speak. And as they're speaking and as you have questions, please do feel free to put the Q&A, put your questions into the Q&A. Thank you again for joining us online for today's LSE IDEAS event. LSE IDEAS is the foreign policy think tank of the London School of Economics. We connect academic knowledge of diplomacy and strategy with the people who use it. If you're interested in other events or research, please look at the website, and that has been put into the chat by David Sutton. Without further ado, we will begin. Again, welcome to the collapse of the Soviet Union 30 years on, transition and Soviet legacy. We will begin with Sergei Plokhii, the professor of Ukrainian history and the director of the Ukrainian Research Institute at Harvard University. A leading authority on Eastern Europe, he has published extensively on the international history of World War II and the Cold War. His books won numerous awards, including the Lionel Gelber Prize for the best English language book on international relations, and the Bally Gifford Prize for nonfiction in the UK. And just so we're clear, our second speaker will be Diana. The third speaker will be Slavo, and the final speaker will be Vlad Zubak. Thank you. Take it away. Apologies.
Thank you very much, Dr. Phillips, for this introduction. It's a great pleasure to be on this panel. And I probably will start where the Soviet 30 years from now moving back in time to the time when the Berlin Wall fell and then the Soviet Union was falling apart as well. And around that time, Francis Fukuyama famously announced the end of history, suggesting that what is actually happening is that the Western democracy became the final form of the human government. And in the last 30 years, probably almost everyone was looking at that and pointing at the real situation, how it was developing in the region, and suggesting that that assessment was actually wrong, or if not wrong, then at least premature. What I want to say here and start with saying is that, yes, absolutely. If you look at, again, all the eyes at that point were on Russia, at Yeltsin, at what was happening in August of 1991 in Moscow. And from that point, from that perspective, certainly the hopes that everyone had around that time, including probably many members on this panel, didn't materialize. But I would also suggest that actually the post-Soviet space today, in terms of the development of a democracy, is a much better place and far away from where it was even during the first years of Gorbachev's perestroika. We certainly have a success of the democratic development in the Baltic states to a degree that it, in terms of their democratic record today, they're ahead of certainly Poland and Hungary, if you look at their neighbors to the west. You have the countries with failed democracy, certainly, and you have a lot of countries in between. But overall, I think it's actually, we are in a better place than we were in even in 1989 or even in 1990. Democracy is contested on many levels within the borders of these new states that were created on the ruins of the Soviet Union and in the conflict between the borders. And for example, the Russo-Ukrainian war and Russo-Ukrainian conflict is also very often framed in those terms. So again, the history in terms of what will happen there with the development of the democracy is far from over. Where I would say the history or some sort of history came to an end would be when you look at the experiment with the command economy, the Soviet command economy, the absence of the and liquidation of the private ownership and private property in the Soviet Union and on the areas that were controlled by the communist regimes. And what we see there, it really doesn't matter what country we look at, but in one way or another, certainly the private property is back. The rule of law is a big questionable issue, but the private property is back, and to a different degree, forms market economy, and the role of that market economy is extremely, extremely important. So even if you look, go beyond the borders of the Soviet Union, you look either at China or you look at what is happening in Cuba, in the countries where the Communist Party survived in power, certainly the old command economy is complete denial of any form of private property is gone. Where also I would say the history came to an end is the story of the old European empires. And the Soviet Union, again, this is a very contested issue. My colleagues debate whether the Soviet Union was an empire. If it was not an empire, what were the elements of the former empire? But what is very clear is that the Soviet Union died the death of an empire. And back in 1990-91, a big and positive surprise was that, unlike it was the case with other empires, what we saw in when it comes to the Soviet Union was that there were no major wars. Again, Chechnya was there and it was going through the 1990s, but there was no war between the republics. Unfortunately, the last 7 years demonstrated to us that that part of the imperial collapse, not that it didn't happen, to a degree it was postponed, and we have today Ukraine is in the news today, but before that, a few months ago, there was Armenia and Azerbaijan were there. So from that point of view, again, if we want to look through the prism of the imperial collapse and the Soviet collapse, there are some additional elements that come into the picture, that were not there back in 1991. And my final comment is on the Cold War. And again, looking at the media today, looking at the headlines, we see a lot of discussion where the Cold War is back. And probably the closest parallel to what happened, what is happening now in that region would be this redefinition of the borders and boundaries of Eastern Europe. So to a degree that Eastern Europe of the old was the contested, the battleground between East and West, the new Eastern Europe, which includes certainly Belarus, Ukraine, Moldova, to a degree Baltic states, is a contested area in this new age in whether we want to call it Cold War or not. There are also differences And that's where I will end, with the players sitting on the international arena in general and other players in the region in particular. And I mean certainly China, which is very active in the region. If you look at the Armenia and Azerbaijan, the Turkey is there, and so the relationship is not just between Russia and between Moscow and Washington. So I'm concluding with saying that, well, if in certain ways we can talk about and of certain elements of history in other areas, that history continues and maybe even is coming back. Thank you very much for your attention.
Thank you so much, Professor Plotkin, and we really appreciate your comments and look forward to hearing more during the Q&A. So we will now move definitively to Dr. Diana Georgescu, Assistant Professor in Eastern European History at the School of Slavonic and Eastern European Studies at University College London. Her research focuses on socialist and post-socialist Romania, with particular interests in the transnational history of childhood and youth, memory studies, gender history, and comparative nationalism. She has published articles on socialist childhood and citizenship, post-socialist memory regimes, gendered representations of national and European identity, post-communist film, national identity, and travel writing. Her current book explores the lived experiences, institutional structures, and ideological constructions of socialist childhood and citizenship, throwing light on the role of children as both objects in Romanian state efforts to raise loyalist socialist citizens and as agents in their own right. And with that, I turn the microphone to you.
Thank you so much, Victoria. And I mean, I'd like to start in a way by echoing Sergei's reference to Fukuyama, but through the words of sociologist Ian Gross, who very early on in the 1990s referred to the revolutions of 1989 as these catch-up revolutions, where he argued that revolutions used to be export commodities, presumably because they had new ideas, new blueprint for a better society to offer, whereas the 1989 revolution appears to be an imported revolution, in part because of this crisscrossing experts throughout Eastern Europe, from business school graduates to constitutional lawyers, that come to bring a model that has already been tried, that the end point of this revolution is already known. It can be reached, he concludes, by an overnight train. And Sergei referenced, you know, this destination point, the market-based liberal democracy, the Western model taught abroad by Western experts to Eastern Europe. And it becomes clear how 1989 came to be written, at least in the 90s, as this story of triumphant liberalism, if you want. But if we look back on this period, you know, with the benefit of hindsight 30 years later, this vision has been challenged both in Eastern Europe and in the world more broadly. In the region, it has been primarily the comeback of authoritarian liberalism in Central Europe, particularly Hungary and Poland, but also scholars would argue the fallout from the economic reforms from the shock therapy being felt throughout the region. One of the things that some of the studies that were published in 2019 on 30 years after the revolutions of 1989, tried to sort of assess this period. And some argues that the values associated with liberalism in the 90s, openness of frontiers, the free flow of people and ideas, the ideals of freedom and human rights, have met with resistance by new regimes in Central Europe. Because if 1989, to some extent, you know, was this year when the walls came down, the recent decade actually saw the erection of over 1,200 kilometers of fences and new borders in Eastern Europe, mostly starting in reaction to the refugee crisis. And also, sociologists like Ivan Krastev would say, by 2010, the Central and Eastern European versions of liberalism had been tainted by two decades of kind of rising inequality, collapse of welfare system, pervasive corruption, and a morally arbitrary redistribution of public property into the hands of a small number of people. Problems which reflected in the high waves of emigration out of Eastern Europe, especially after some of these countries joined the European Union. And indeed, these reforms generated by what anthropologists of the transition called winners or losers of the transitions, categories that are defined in generational, but also in class terms, in access to education terms. And those close observers that analyze these experiences kind of from within the transition also noted that people's relation with the past, including their support for socialist values, was significantly altered by a shift in the experience of transition, maybe around the 2000s, from what was initially perceived as a temporary inconvenience on this road to capitalism to what became a kind of a seemingly permanent discomfort. Yeah, so the post-socialist period became something that people assessed in its own terms, rather than just by comparison to the traumatic socialist past. And one of the ways in which my research explored how Eastern Europeans reacted to post-socialist transformations was to examine a rather puzzling phenomenon of post-socialist nostalgia across the region, but which probably emerged first and most visibly in unified Germany and known there as Ostalgie. And whether it involved, you know, Berliners going to a disco that sought to reconstruct GDR times with East German drinks, with music, and even kind of the old cover charge. Or in Sarajevo, in former Yugoslavia, Cafe Tito, which also revives some of the Yugoslav culture and material culture. Or by the 2000s, by the mid-2000s, even in places where nostalgia came late, you could see Bulgarians able to frequent a restaurant named Checkpoint Charlie, Romanians, small groups of Romanians gathering at the grave of former communist dictator Nicolae Ceausescu to commemorate him on his birthday. And from these more politically charged reactions to things like websites and Facebook groups collecting, reviving socialist culture, whether in the name of childhood as this Romanian Facebook group or remembering youth and elements of this kind. So the phenomenon was puzzling because international journalists, domestic ones, academics, politicians were asking, why do these Eastern European societies that rebelled to dismantle authoritarian regimes in 1989 seem all of a sudden to long for a traumatic past, you know, of economic destitution, of political oppression? And the phenomenon was largely dismissed in the press as a malady, as a sickness, yeah, as a sort of collective amnesia that people have forgotten the trauma of socialism. And it was believed or attributed, at least in the beginning, to older generations or even the beneficiaries of the socialist regime. But over time, over the past decade, I'd say in particular, public surveys, especially in Romania, showed that positive associations with a socialist past among younger generations, some of whom had no direct experience of socialism, were coming from these very young generations. And it generated a you know, kind of real moral panic in the sense that public education is failing, often in the face of family memories, family transmissions of memories. So my work and that of others on nostalgia was rather to understand what it expresses, what it stands for. And in many cases, of course, it has different meanings for different actors, but for the so-called losers of the transition, often nostalgia is seen as a weapon, as a form of resistance that emerged in reaction to experiences of loss, be this loss of jobs, of stability, of welfare networks, or even of a sense of identity. This applied more to unified Germany, that the revival of socialist material culture constituted a sense of solidarity with other Aussies as against the Wesses, the East and West Germans. And that often observers would argue nostalgia does not entail necessarily an identification with a former socialist state, but rather a criticism of the present, of the new democratic politics and economic reforms. Some anthropologists have also argued that nostalgia sometimes codifies trauma, but not so much the trauma of the socialist past as that of the post-socialist present. And there are anthropologists on Bulgaria, like Gerald Creed, who looked, for example, at nostalgia or expressions of nostalgia more recently amongst Bulgarian villagers and saw that they codified reactions to the socioeconomic disruptions that they actually experienced in the first post-communist decade when the country was going through this, he argues, ill-conceived liquidation of collective farms, which could be as disorienting, as transformative as collectivization under socialism, and which generated this kind of massive out-migration and the sense of abandonment, particularly in Bulgarian villages, some of which were left almost empty. And I actually wanted to end on this note on what happened on emigration and what happened when the expectations of prosperity did not materialize. And we saw a massive flow of population out of the region, especially young people, which had profound economic, political, and maybe even psychological consequences. Romania in 2019 was second only to war-torn Syria in emigration, having seen around 3.4 million people, a vast majority of them younger than 40, living. And actually, I could end with this iconic image of the Romanian Revolution and its revolutionaries, the top one, which was taken in 1989, a photo of two young revolutionaries holding this placard that said, "Our children will be free." And that was recreated by journalists in 2019, so 30 years after, when the two revolutionaries are now in Canada and the United States, and they're holding a placard, yeah, saying, "Our children are free enough." So it seems to me that while, you know, in the UK, especially in the context of Brexit, we are discussing concerns with immigration, in Eastern Europe, you see what some have called even a demographic panic, fueled by these fears of an unending stream of immigration, but coupled with aging population and with low birth rate, and which some would say, you know, might explain even this kind of anxiety about refugees and immigrants being assimilated into Central Europe. Thank you. I'll leave it here.
Thank you so much. And we look forward to hearing more from you. And now I'd like to present Dr. Slavo Radosevic, a professor of industry and innovation studies at the University College of London, where he has also been acting director of the School of Slavonic Eastern European Studies. He has worked at the University of Sussex as a researcher in Croatia, as a government economist, and was a federal undersecretary for development in the former Yugoslavia. His main research interests are in science technology, industrial change, foreign direct investments, and innovation policy in Europe, with a particular reference to Central and Eastern Europe and former USSR economies. He has published extensively in international journals in these areas and has edited several volumes on these issues. He acts as an expert for the UN Economic Commission for Europe, for which he worked on former Soviet Union economies. He has been an advisor to the EC and the World Bank, UNESCO, and others, and other organizations. He has been a special advisor to the ECDG Commissioner for Regional and Urban Policy. Welcome.
Thank you. Thank you, Victoria. I want to bring into this very interesting panel, where we had first historical perspective, then we had sociological perspective, and I want to bring more economic and I would call it more heterodox perspective on the last 30 years, which is a kind of potential bridge for with the other panelists. So from my perspective, when I look at these last 30 years, I think that there are three major political ideological shifts which reflects kind of the intellectual kind of environment of the last 30 years. And now with the benefits of hindsight, kind of we can contemplate that. First is this shift from kind of real existing socialism, as it was called at that time, towards something which for 20 years, especially transition economies, calls open market economy, whatever that means in inverted commas. Second is the shift from the closed economies, which had this inward-oriented industrialization towards more open economy, which is led by foreign investment, by the opening, you know, kind of that was the basic idea, because that will lead the improvements in efficiency and technology. Third is the shift from the dominance of omnipotent socialist state towards more regulatory state. State should disappear from the economic life. And so now we have to ask ourselves what has happened after 30 years regarding this shift. What we could see when we look at the different economies, that there were periods of growth and many economies were successful and are still successful. But in overall, we didn't see kind of catching up in economic growth, which means producing sustainable growth over a long period. We had this successful period from 1999 until 2008, which then revealed whole fragility of the growth and sustainability of growth with big differences across different parts of the former post-socialist world, where obviously EU member states in a much more favorable position and are now beefed up with the larger EU subsidies. So we had this variety of outcome, but in overall, one could say that this growth was much less a result of what these economies were doing in terms of transition economics program, because this was the view that, and I'm referring now to Sergi, to this idea that there is a kind of clear paradigm and progression. What has come out after 30 years that basically those economies which were growing, that the growth was not really related to your progress in transition. Actually, you get what you would expect anyhow from developing economics, that economies which are behind, they were growing at a higher rate, and economies which were sticking to kind of transition economics canons were not necessarily doing very well. So we have this a kind of, after 30 years, a failure of one kind of view of the economy, which is reduced to the economy only as a market economy. We could see now that the outcome was much more result, not only what these economies were doing in terms of progress in transition, and we can discuss whether that notion has any meaning today and whether it's only a historic relic and how we go about it, and was much more the result of structural, technological, institutional legacies in these economies. And for me, it's interesting, basically, when we compare the post-socialist period, transition period, with the socialist period, we see that in both periods, there was a kind of one principle either of central planning hierarchy, and the second principle on the absolute role of the market. What we actually see now, after 30 years, that in both periods, countries that have done better were those which kind of had a much more kind of hybrid system, hybrid principle. The same in socialism, economies that had to rely on second economy, on informality, that was crucial to survival of the system. So we see today that economies that were kind of much more mixed economies, which combine the role of the state with the markets are doing, or were doing, or will do in the future relatively better. That is the idea that in each of these kind of pure form, we see one governance principle, which if you bring it to the absolute, basically then you don't generate sustainable long-term growth. So if there is any lesson, I think for us today, that the economies that can grow, that can sustain and relieve people of poverty and lead them to a higher income level are those which operate as hybrid economies, which means that you have to have a variety of governing principles, variety of sectors operating on different principles, and that this is one of the crucial factors, which I think that is something which political scientists understood much earlier than economists. It's in political science, if I think about the carotid or the end of transition paradigm, economists still haven't kind of accepted that fully, because if you accept it, then you are in the world where you have a variety of different capitalism or different type of regimes, and then you have to evaluate each of them on their own merits. So for me, that is a kind of major lesson of these 30 years, which is a quite important when we think about the options for the future and what these countries can do. But I hope that in our discussion we'll touch more on the transition paradigm itself, because we lived for 20 years within that paradigm. Countries were measured based on that paradigm. And it is time now to say what it was all for and what it led to. So I would like to finish basically more with a question and an open discussion on that side. So thank you.
Thank you so much. And we look forward to engaging with your question. And finally, we have Professor Vlad Zubak, a professor of international history at the London School of Economics, with expertise on the Cold War, the Soviet Union, Stalinism, and Russia's intellectual history in the 20th century. His most recent books are Collapse, The Fall of the Soviet Union, 2021, The Idea of Russia, The Life and Work of Dmitry Lakhachev, and The Life and the Century, A Failed Empire, the Soviet Union in the Cold War, from Stalin to Gorbachev, and Zhivago's Children, The Last Russian Intelligentsia. So with that, I welcome you and hand it over to Professor Zubak.
Thank you, Victoria. I would return appropriately to history, because we began with history and then moved through sociology and economics. Fukuyama is a nice philosopher. I recall George Kennan, who was a thinker who lived and started much earlier than Fukuyama. And at some point, I think it was in 1947, he took his students, he taught at the War College, through history on a sort of a reverse time machine. And he demonstrated the power of 30 years. I think in his case, it was not 30, but I'm slightly rounding it up. In his case, it was the power of 25 years. So he took students 25 or 30 years back, let's say from 47 to 1917, and said, who could in 1917 envisage and guess all those changes that would happen between 1917 and 47? And then he took them, of course, even further to 1887. And again, who could have thought of the First World War, Russian Revolution, and all that stuff? I think that illustrates in a sort of non-philosophical, but you know, maybe simplistic, but very powerful way, how difficult it is to predict what will happen in 30 years. And I certainly think of myself back in 1991, when the Soviet Union collapsed. I had no clue where we would end 30 years later. All I learned since then, during these 30 years, that history is not linear. It's not reduced to the progress of democratization and even to economic growth. It's infinitely more complicated things. So if we take a look at where Russia is in all this process, this is even worse than the glass half empty. The glass is being emptied literally before our eyes during the last decade. 10 years ago, though, many Russians supported Putin because, you know, against all recipes of IMF and World Bank, he took Russia out of total doldrums. Russia was during the 90s a basket case economically, and restored it in more than one dimension. So Russia, as I would like to remind, was a visible or invisible element in the transition of Eastern and Central Europe, of course, after 1989-91. I've just read a wonderful book about Václav Havel, written by his friend, and Russia figures there only in a cameo way, but very importantly during the chapter Searching for Allies, the chapter calls. And Russia figures as a highly chaotic, highly unpredictable, big country with spikes of xenophobia violence, and you get the picture of unpredictability. So, of course, in 1993, as we know, Havel, the president of Czechoslovakia, and Valenza, president of Poland, appealed to Clinton to expand NATO. So I think, when we discuss the expansion of NATO, we always go to political aspect of this story, but we should underline the profound historical and cultural aspects of this story. The image of Russia, of course. When Yeltsin destroyed the Soviet Union, and then my book argued that the Russian Federation and Yeltsin in particular were absolutely instrumental in destroying what they believed and what they called at the time as the worst totalitarian empire in human history. I'm just citing what they said in 1991. They expected that by deleting the Soviet Union from the map, by restoring Russia, the name of Russia on the map, they somehow would reach out back to the civilized world, by which they meant, of course, the West. In reality, something more ironic happened, and all historians, of course, will smirk and understand, because for all neighbors of the former Soviet Union, Russia was no better. It was still a giant, unpredictable country with bad imperial past and many cases of dominance and invasion of neighbors. So one sees Yeltsin and his Russian revolutionaries, the destructors, the terminators of the Soviet Union, making a rather naive mistake of short-sightedness. Instead of going like Kennan recommended 30 years back and then 30 more years back and thinking about what they were doing, they focused on the immediacy of the moment. What's interesting also, you of course find a lot of that in Eastern Europe. It started with this cultural debate, who belongs to Europe? And clearly, when I was in Budapest in the 90s and attended the seminar on this, I didn't find Russia belonging. It was still not securitized, but sure enough, in a few years, securitization of cultural debates, securitization of historical memories, both recent and not so recent, came almost as a wishful thinking. It's worthwhile talking about path dependency. Normally, this term is applied to Russia because it always goes back to bad ways, path dependency. But it also applies to everyone, I think. It applies to Eastern and Central Europe, despite their marvelous and admirable leap to democracy and the European project. Something remained the same, and that something is for instance, related to Russia. When we deal with the United States, I just watched that very serious senatorial hearings yesterday about on Russia and Ukraine. And if one views it historically and culturally, one sees, only Putin's name was mentioned. And, Russians were figured there as some background for Mr. Putin. But if one generalizes, one sees American policymakers and particularly senators viewing Russia as just big, unpredictable, and systemically bad. That is, we back to path dependency. And by the way, one finds the origins of this, of course, many years ago, but also in the debates, famous debates inside the Bush administration in the fall of 1991, what to do with the Soviet collapse. And there were two lines. One line was James Baker, Secretary of State, said we have to deal with the Soviet Union because, this country is a key to our security, the existentially key to our security because it's another nuclear superpower. Another line was by Cheney. Serhii knows this very well. He wrote about it himself as well. When Cheney said, the smaller Russia is, the better for us if Russia goes bad. Let's split Ukraine from Russia. And Ukraine must be independent in any case. So you find, this kind of meandering between these two lines for a couple of years, 92, 93, but remarkably quickly, the Cheney line triumphed. And this line triumphed even before Russia really began to go bad. It sort of triumphed already in 1994, before the war in Chechnya began, and 10 years before the first Maidan in Ukraine took place. So one wonders, there's some deeper things in history that we often miss when we focus on linearity and we focus on very important trends, even when they last through 30 years. We should open our minds to broader things. Thank you.
Thank you so much. These were wonderful and compelling talks. I'd like to open it up, and perhaps we can go in the order in which you spoke, give you all a response to respond to one another. We have wonderful questions in the Q&A, and maybe I'll take the host's privilege and throw in a thought or a question that I had, kind of going back to the basics of this talk. And the idea of the collapse. And I'm fascinated by this because 30 years later would certainly imply that 91 was a moment. And I'm interested to hear whether, how you view this, how we periodize the Cold War, how that allows us to think about the present, and whether we should think of this as a collapse or a process of change. Legacy implies that the Soviet Union was something static, but I think all of your talks implied something much different. Is it a collapse? Was it a crumbling? Is there a rebuilding? Is it a rebuilding on something inherently unstable? And in that, I'm always fascinated by the idea of progress. And this ideal of progress, whether it's economic, whether it's social, whether it's historical, this foundational belief within the Soviet system and obviously the United States as well from the Enlightenment on this idea of progress and how, if we're looking at a collapse, how do we grapple with this? But you don't have to answer my question. Feel free to address one another.
So, do you want us to go?
Yes, please.
In the order that we spoke. Okay, excellent. It was really rich and interesting discussion. And in terms of the Soviet collapse, probably we can start with the collapse of ideology. Certainly, the Soviet modernization was. The idea of progress was about delivering that progress actually in a faster way, in a more effective way than the capitalist system was supposed to do that. And by the 1980s, it became absolutely failed. There was no question about that. And it's also very interesting. In the 1980s was the time the material base of the communism was supposed to be built. The communism in some form was supposed to arrive. And of course, what arrived in the 1980s was the falling economy, ideology that was falling apart. And from that point of view, the actors everywhere, in the central government, in the republics, in opposition, in the Communist Party, they were looking for the way out. They were looking for the alternative. And the alternative available at that time was some form of a democracy and nationalism, some form of national identity in which creation modern nation state was now linked to progress. And in that sense, that's what was in common. But then I certainly 100% agree with what Vlad was saying, in a sense that this path dependency is something that we really maybe overuse in certain conditions. But really, this is something that we should take a close look at, because if you look at the democratic progress or economic progress happening in the post-Soviet space, the countries that are leading are the Baltic states, the countries' trajectories from the rest of the Soviet Union and the Central Asian region. So I'll stop here.
Thank you so much.
I can actually go on by answering a bit of your questions and then referring to some of the questions in the Q&A chat section. I think it's a really good question. And do we think about 1989 and what happened as a point of collapse, or do we think about it more as a process? There is, and in terms of periodization of Cold War history and how it helps us think about the present, I keep thinking of Alexei Yurchak's book, whose title is so evocative. Yeah, everything was forever until it was no more. So I think the fact that we conceptualize 1989 as a collapse, as eventful, has to do on the one hand with a sense of surprise from a regime under which we had lived. I mean, most of the socialist regimes had come to a state of ossification. Yeah, so there was a sense of permanence that was violated in 1989. Yeah, so there was a sense that all of a sudden everything happens with amazing speed. And it makes me think of the two documentaries produced in the 1990s by this Romanian director, Andrei Vujica, who was living in Germany. One was on the Romanian Revolution, and it was called Videograms of a Revolution. It was based entirely on found footage, and it was extremely eventful. Portraying the violence, the bloody events, the bloody encounters in the street. And the other one was released a bit later in 1995. It was called Out of the Present. And it juxtaposed footage of Russian cosmonaut Sergei Krikalev's 10 months on board of the Mir space station in 1991-92 with images of what was happening on Earth during his absence, basically the disintegration of the Soviet Union. And kind of in a less eventful, kind of manner. So I do think in some sense, the more we research the period, especially that we see continuities, but the symbolic imagery of 1989, I think, was one of rupture, of collapse. And it happened to some extent, at least symbolically in some countries. So that's to your question. And I think in the chat, I'm not sure, do you want us to respond to questions in chat as well, or?
I think we'll just have you all respond to one another, and then I'll take the questions as soon as everybody has had a chance to respond.
Sure, thanks.
Okay, I would add something to this discussion, which I think so far has been very much ignored, because I think we cannot understand the collapse and what happened after that unless we don't bring a kind of global perspective, unless we don't really fully bring into the picture the globalization, the fact that the last 30 years was a period of financialization, financial capitalism, absolute role of the market, where the state should be a market state to facilitate that, you know, kind of. And obviously, there is this bad coincidence of these countries moving from the socialist system into that system of highly financialized capitalism, which created the dynamic that it created. Of course, naturally, what comes and what we can see globally, there is always natural conflict between the logic of the market and logic of the state, and so we see this kind of interaction going on and how it. Then get expressed in different countries. In this part of the world, I like this distinction which come from my research, which is a distinction between a foreign and domestic-led, let's call it modernization, where you have also this distinction on dependent market economies being Central European, East European, and then you have a new notion called state-permeated economies. These are all kind of different responses on the challenges of globalization, where we see these kind of trade-offs between one and the other. None of these two modes are kind of dynamic. My own theory is that basically catching up or sustainable growth, recovery, resolution of social problems comes when countries are able to be open, but at the same time retain a degree of autonomy, a control. And this is actually a very complicated issue because it's a trade-off between different forces. And unfortunately, in this part of the world, we see these two extremes. Kind of, we see fragility of one and the other trade-offs. And God knows whether there will come a point where we will see ways of reconciliation between this logic of the market and the logic of the state, because these countries are part of the global problems, part of global kind of challenges of globalization. I think to conclude, I think we have to bring that. We cannot just focus on them, on their legacies, and have this kind of internal perspective, unless we don't look at it in a broader global context. Thank you.
Okay, if I may add a few words, I think it's an excellent question, Victoria, about collapse and how it is related to the idea of progress. Because if I had written my book, 20 or so years ago, I would probably have had a different title for my book. It, what most probably would have been called Revolution or something. Because when the old collapses, this is usually a cause for rejoice and the jubilation. When you're sort of all your ideological matrix is clear and goes forward in the classic idea of a progress. And certainly the beauty of the moment of 1989 and 91 was that so many people believed that the future is clear. As it turned out, they simply conflated progress with the West. And for Eastern Europeans, they conflated progress specifically with the EU project. And then, as Krastev, as we know, wrote very, very evocatively, the light began to dim. Maybe it hasn't failed, but it definitely began to dim, and new problems emerged. China was mentioned, but without China, it's impossible to understand new complexity of what is progress. China achieved remarkable progress by all standards, much more remarkable than any Eastern European countries and Russia combined. And it did it not on the path of democracy. And that complicates the conversation. Who could have predicted in 1989, after the Tiananmen Square, when China was isolated and no investments were coming to China, that just a few years later, a Chinese miracle would begin and China would be discussed by the same kind of people who were totally obsessed in 1989-91 in the West about Eastern Europe and the future of the Soviet Union. They're now obsessed about China, such as, for instance, Graham Allison. When we talk about Putin's Russia today, sometimes I read comments in journalistic comments, Putin is so much afraid of a democratic Ukraine, because in the emergence of a Slavic democratic country next door to the Russians is such a threat to him. I wish it was so, but in reality, it's more complicated. Putin is no longer afraid of democracy, I'm afraid. He learned how to manipulate the vote. He came to believe, and with him, unfortunately, many Russians came to believe during the 90s that democracy, to a large extent, is a sham, and the rule of financialized oligarchy, back to what Professor Slava Radovich told us, And this is just a new constellation of factors, I think, that we have to view holistic, not pull out one strand such as, authitarians are afraid of democracy. We're unfortunately living through a much worse period. We're living through the period when democracy is no longer an absolute value and is not so much afraid by new authoritarians. You know, was Mussolini in the 1920s so afraid of liberal democracy? The answer is no. Of course, you move 30 years forward, you see a different picture. So again, the power of 30. Victoria asked about the Cold War. For me personally, it just reminds very badly of the end of 1983, what is happening between Russia and the West. Complete and utter failure of diplomacy. The end of diplomatic talks. You know, you use force to bring Biden to talk to Putin even once. This is ridiculous. You listen to senators in the US Senate. It's like the end of the 83 or maybe even early 50s for you, going back to the active role of the Senate to promote the very hard anti-communist, anti-Russian agenda. We're back to this in a sense. And I think it's extremely dangerous.
I wonder if I can make a comment sort of to Slavo's point about globalization. Because it seems to me that when we talk about globalization, we tend to consider it primarily in as Westernization and look at it in the post-socialist period. But there is now a really interesting and promising body of research on the Cold War looking at a different kind of globalization that socialist countries were part of during the Cold War, and that is those East-South exchanges, the exchanges with the global South, the opening of socialist countries through expertise, but also economically and educational exchanges with countries in Africa, Asia, Latin America, and so on. So this is kind of ongoing research on this issue and a different form of globalization, I'll say, that than what we experienced after 89, where there was a shift from these types of relationships with the global South to the West. And some have argued that even that looked a little bit as the third worldization of Eastern Europe, that during the Cold War, Eastern Europe was part of the developing world. And all of a sudden, by comparison to the developed civilized West after 89, it just appears more as economically backward. So that's...
if I can just add to what Diane said, I grew up in former Yugoslavia in a kind of intellectual sense. I grew up with this idea of global South, starting from Latin American dependencia, non-aligned movement, and so on. So the socialist world for me was a completely enigma, you know, kind of say. But that was a different type of really of globalization. It was. I mean, the nature of globalization has dramatically changed. I would call it before like a, let's call it on the West, Bretton Woods globalization and Cold War, and then you have this type of globalization. But we have to really to talk then about the nature of contemporary globalization and how that affects Eastern Europe, former Soviet Union, and why this part of the world became so vulnerable, why income inequalities erupted so much, and why the states were not able to manage to negotiate that opening process. And for me, the crucial variable is there when you have a collapse of state, where state is not able to mediate successfully conflict between labor and capital, between domestic and foreign capital, then you get really all what you get. You get you know, processes which are completely then can be uncontrolled, which do not reflect social consensus, and then we get what we get. Thank you.
Thank you all. We're going to go to the questions in the Q&A. If you want to look through them, feel free to and address them as you wish. I wanted to put a few of them together on a larger scale, the issue of inequality, which I think you all touch on, and the idea of memory politics feeds into this. And one of the questions was, how did the neoliberal transformation cause poverty, inequality, marginalization, or was it changed? Was inequality reconfigured somehow? And what are the implications of inequality? So these are big questions. Please go ahead.
In terms of inequality, maybe it would make sense maybe to Slava to start on that, given that that's really goes toward the issue really of economics and social orders and so on.
Slava, would you like to come in?
Yeah, I think this I think your question builds on this. For me, this is closely related to the kind of in many countries, collapse of the state, because first we have this technology-induced inequality, so to say, because of the nature of technologies today, which lead this polarization of labor force. Second, we have a China effect, where this part of the world have completely lost in that. But then we have a third problem, which is the collapse of the state, which was not able to resolve conflicting distributional interests, because that's the role of the state. That's what state serves for, you know, kind of. If the state is not able to resolve the distributional interest, try to reduce this income inequality, try to have a balance between the openness and autonomy, then we get what we get. So I think we have a bad coincidence of these three factors together, which then led to huge problems, which, you know, will stay there. The issue is how do we get out of it, you know? And I think this cannot be resolved unless also kind of the nature of globalization changes around. These simply countries are too weak, because then you will get maybe extremes, highly dependent economies, or you will get something which I can call Iranization of Russia, kind of closing economy itself to itself, you know, kind of. But these are not responses. None of these responses is actually something which can lead these countries in a kind of long-term future, and is cannot respond to the whole issues of sustainability, of sustainable growth, climate change, all these new things. So we don't have responses currently to that. Thank you.
Thank you. Would anybody else like to come in?
I'd like to say a few words on the questions on memory politics and memory in general. I think there was one more specifically on Poland and Hungary and the role that trauma, such as the Nazi and subsequent communist role, might have played in today's rising Euroscepticism. And I think first, when we talk about collective or social memory, we have to understand that it's not necessarily monolithic. Yeah, so it's not the memory of everybody in Poland or the memory of everybody in Hungary. And that these experiences of Nazi occupation, of Nazi rule, and then communist rule affected people differently. But what we know from the study of especially official memory, yeah, sort of state-sponsored memory in Hungary, in Poland, is that we have this the museums of crimes of communism. We have, and those are generally, they present a narrative of communism that's particularly interesting, where the Hungarian nation or the Polish nation are seen as sort of just the object of an imposition of communism, and communism is sort of external or alien to them. And the running thread in these museums from before the communist establishment to the collapse of communism is that of a national identity that sort of continues despite this external seemingly impositions, and especially when it comes to Nazi and communist rule, there's been quite a debate, and I think people discuss. There is even this article that's made quite a bit of an impact when it was published, and I think it was called "Hot Memory, Cold Memory." To ask which is the most profound, pervasive memory in Europe? Is it the memory of the Holocaust or the memory of communism? Concluding to some extent that the memory of the Holocaust is more sort of enduring and shaping European identity. But there were certain, I remember definitely in Romania, there were certain lots of discussions around the fact that the EU itself would not criminalize communist rule in the same way in which it criminalized, for example, denial of the Holocaust. So that's indeed quite a contentious topic, I think, of memory and collective memory, social memory.
Just wanted to say that, as you probably noticed, the politics of history and politics of memory involved one important participant, President Putin himself, who published several historical articles on Ukraine and on the origins of World War II. And what particularly incensed him, clearly incensed and cut to the quick, I think, even personally, was the claim that both the Soviet Union and the Nazi Germany were co-equally responsible for the outbreak of World War II. You know, you can dismiss it as Putin's antics and his reactionary ideology and all that stuff. But I think, again, it goes very deeply into what Diana just spoke and what, you know, we understand how Central Europeans try to reconstitute their centrality in Europe. The whole, you know, semantics about not being Eastern anymore, but becoming Central is evocative. And what they did initially in their museums, they did equalize the experience of communist tyranny with the Nazi. But in a sense, that worked even more against the communist experience, because it was Soviet, even more, if you scratch the surface, Russian imposition on them. And while Germany, after all those terrible crimes, nobody would argue that Germany does not belong to Europe. Russia, you may contest whether Russia belongs to Europe or not. So in a sense, Russia is worse by not being European and committing all those crimes and contributing to the origins of World War II.
Yes, maybe I can jump in on the issue of memory as well. Because what you see there is certainly the topics that were suppressed during the Soviet time or communist regimes. And if the crimes of Nazi Germany were certainly part of the mainstream national narratives, the crimes of the communist regimes, either local or when you talk about occupational regimes, certainly something that actually people were not allowed to talk about, to write about, to research. And in my opinion, at least part of the story is really that important part of the experience of the region through the German occupation and through the Soviet occupation. Now, this is of course something that we can and discuss and agree or disagree. The European story is also very interesting in the sense that really the former Eastern Europe is now Central Europe or Northern Europe. And at least in my experience, that was very important for the narrative of the 1990s in the former Eastern Europe. And it became now more important and central for the new Eastern Europe, in Ukraine in particular. So the issues of belonging or not belonging to Europe. So it looks like we have this shift that happens in terms of geography, and it also happens in terms of time. And if I can jump now, once I'm already on the subject, if I can jump to the one of the questions that was there on the current Russian-Ukrainian war and whether there will be an escalation or not, because very often the question is asked whether the Putin will invade or not, and the argument that at least in Ukraine happened in 2014. So the question is the escalation. And of course, there is difficult to answer this question. What we know for sure after 2014, that this is a clear possibility. The point that I want to make in regard of the current development is draw a parallel with the Cold War. And we were talking about the Cold War before that. And probably the closest parallel with the current crisis is the crisis around Poland in 1980, in December of 1980. That's the parallel that Jan Brzezinski, who recently published an article on that subject, saying that his fathers, Zbigniew Brzezinski and Carter, were able to stop the Soviet invasion of Poland. And the recently published documents say that actually there was no plans per se on the political level for that invasion, but there was a threat of invasion as a political tool. And I think that that's in terms of any parallels with the Cold War, we are back where we were in the 1980s. Again, Vlad was making this parallels with the 1980s. So it's not just the case of the invasion per se in military force as an instrument of foreign policy, but it's also the threat of invasion as a political and diplomatic tool.
Thank you so much. You anticipated where I was going to take things into the very specific. So thank you so much for that segue. Each of you could reach into your toolbox, whether it's economics, history, cultural understanding, understanding even of childhood. I heard Stephen Kotkin talk about the reason that the Cold War would never end was because the playgrounds were never taken down. Where are we with Ukraine, and what can you tell us about what to expect? Slavo, do you want to come in with an economic viewpoint, or Vlad?
I would put to Vlad if it is directly a question related to the contemporary situation. I was more thinking about the more fundamental issues which underlie this, what we are talking about. And maybe before I give to Vlad, for me, fundamental issue is this. One of the questions in the chat was, will Russia ever be democratic? But I think what is for me implicit in today's crisis of democracy is really the very notion of democracy and whether that can be equalized to electoral democracy. And I think it becomes more and more clear that it cannot be identified only with electoral democracy, that there are, it is one of several components of it, kind of. And this leads me to our assumption of the last 30 years that market automatically bring democracy. What the last 30 years, or especially last 20 years, have shown that market can operate, I wouldn't say without democracy, but definitely not with a kind of proper liberal democracy, that there are different type of capitalism, and that illiberal democracy, authoritarian capitalism, can well flourish in the market economy. That comes even to the highest point. If you remember a year ago, economists was critical about China, or China cannot carry on in science innovation because that requires a creativity, that requires freedom. I don't know. Maybe, China can carry on even in the technology-based growth in the regime which it has. And that's quite scary. And so all our notions of what is democracy and how we define a question here. So I wouldn't like our discussion to be reduced on the when we talk about democracy, on electoral democracy. But I leave the Ukraine to Vladislav.
Oh, I think it's always useful to discuss Ukraine and Russia in conjunction. In fact, I was struck in the new book by Mary Sarot, Not One Inch. Initially, even the United States wanted to expand NATO in stages, but the second stage was totally dedicated in 1992-93 to Ukraine and Russia being cultivated for membership in NATO together. And at some point, the Americans decided to separate them. That's an interesting story. A few words about Russian democracy, as Slava mentioned. Russians will become democratic when they will decide to do so. Well, it was a great tragedy, I think, that liberal democracy was imposed on them in the early 90s, as the joke is, as Catherine the Great imposed potato on Russian peasants. The same canon whom I already quoted had once said, let them be Russians. I think it's, with all the rush, transitorial rush to democratize everything and everyone, including Afghanistan, we forget one simple thing, that it's not only economic level, not only economic growth, not only, refrigerator and prosperity that is linked to democracy. Democracy is an experience that linked to nationalism. Russian nationalism unfortunately became separated from democracy. With Ukraine, it turned out to be very different, and because of Russian behavior in 2014-15. The irony is that before that, the situation with democracy, at least as far as Ukrainians thought of it, was not brilliant as well. Aggression, external aggression, evoked Ukrainian nationalism and love for democracy as something totally opposed to their neighbor, to Russia. As for invasion, I would leave it to strategists to conclude, but I would take a huge risk to say that indeed it was, as Serhii said, it was rather a political tool on Putin's part to force the West to reach some kind of a non-aggression pact. Yes, we all know, those of us who know better, how things happen inside NATO, that Putin will never get a non-aggression pact. Plus, but the situation is tragic in many ways, tragic for Ukrainians and for the Russians, because they're now essentially facing each other. And no matter what, would NATO expand or not expand, this is the line where troops will stay and periodically concentrate, just as they were stationed in the bad old days of the Cold War, on another divide between the two Germanies. So either we have to find a diplomatic solution for it, or to have what we have. And I don't think sanctions will help, because Mr. Putin made it very clear. NATO is a hostile bloc for Russia. And as long as hostile bloc tries to expand and bring its power to Russia's borders, it must be stopped. I'm afraid some of my countrymen will find it appealing, because in Russian mentality, national mentality, nationalist mentality, it very much resonates, unfortunately or unfortunately, with the previous cases of expansion from Europe. Doesn't matter if it's peaceful, or doesn't matter who is the aggressor here, who was first. A Russian genie of nationalism is waking up, and we're heading for trouble if we continue to behave in this way.
Thank you so much. Anna, do you want to come in?
Yeah.
Sorry, go ahead.
Yeah, just a few comments on the Russo-Ukrainian war that is going on and the impact on Ukraine. I think that it's became really a major booster for mobilization of the society and for the rise of Ukrainian national identity and Ukraine became more homogeneous in the sense of you look at the last two presidential elections, the two candidates come to power with the absolute majority of the vote. There's no clear divides in terms of geography, something that was a norm really in Ukraine before 2014. So there is a major, major impact of the war, partially loss of the territory, but most of all is the mobilization against the outside threat and aggression. In terms of democracy, I think that Ukraine marches to its own drumbeat, whether there is war or no war. So wars normally are, and conflicts and threats normally are something that either slows down or threatens democratic development. Ukraine really showed its commitment to democratic developments through two colored revolutions, the first 2004 and another 2013. Those were two attempts really in Ukraine to institute in the country the some form of authoritarian control. So more or less following the norm that really is embodied in the Soviet, post-Soviet space by Russia, Belarus, Kazakhstan, and so on and so forth. And both of those attempts actually ended with this popular uprisings. Again, I would certainly agree in terms of the mobilization of the Ukrainian nationalist national identity and unity around the state. Ukraine became much more homogeneous. The democratic tradition, I think it's more in the category of the path dependency. Again, there are deeper roots and certainly roots that go beyond, deeper than the Crimea. So.
Thank you so much. Diana, would you like to come in?
Not so much on Ukraine and Russia, but I was just reflecting on one of the questions in the chat I think from asking to what extent the current problems are rooted rather in former dissidents' camps, not former communists, referring to Applebaum's article in Foreign Affairs, The Fall and Rise of Communists, and saying now Polish and Hungarian illiberal democracies are built by younger second-tier anti-communists. This makes me think, so the question is more on Hungary and Poland, I guess, but makes me think of how central to post-socialist politics in Romania the whole dismissal of political actors as communists or former communists was. There is even the phrase that, you know, the Red Plague. So basically a lot of the civil society and the liberal right parties on the right side of the political spectrum define themselves primarily through opposition to the party that initially was ruled primarily by sort of second tier communist nomenclatura, and by now it's actually really, really hard to say what, if anything, in that Social Democrat Party is really a communist actor or a continuity. And there are a lot more commonalities or similarities between actors. I mean, corruption, they're all involved in corruption scandals. And there is a thirst, I feel, on the Romanian political scene for alternatives, which is why parties that kind of operate only with, let's say, an anti-corruption platform, and it's unclear where they stand ideologically on other issues, have been quite successful in past years, including now most recently right-wing party during COVID, during the last elections. So it's, I think that that's a good question, you know, to what extent we can still 30 years later put blame on these continuities and on these particular actors. Again, anthropologists of transition have come up with really, I think, good categories for us to analyze these processes. And Catherine Verdery for Romania coined this term of antreprachiks. Yeah, the former apparatchiks who had become entrepreneurs in the 90s because they had the economic and the social capital to do it and political connections. But I think by now, so reflecting in a sense this continues, but I think by now we are looking at least in countries in the European Union, and there are studies on this in a sort of European Union funded type of corruption and a different category, different actors within politics that could be fueling some of these problems.
Victoria, if you would allow me, I really didn't plan to say anything about Ukraine, but I have a basically question for Sergei and Vlad, because I worked in Ukraine. I have friends there. My heart bleeds when I see the dangers and the situation. But would they first agree that the situation in which we find ourselves today is the result of, let's call it, geopolitical failures of both West and Russia? And how did we come to that situation where actually there was a huge potential with Ukraine being, you can call it either buffer or bridge between the West and Russia? And why that opportunity was squandered? And how did we come to this situation that basically the geopolitical failure in which we live today can be only resolved how? By some global change in geopolitics, which doesn't look like. So maybe they, as historians, can give us some insight. Was it a kind of slipping into the leadership on both sides, slipping into that, and not seeing that the only way to avoid such conflicts is really having a bridge in between, or buffer, however you want to call it?
Yes, maybe I will. I can certainly start. Again, I look at the situation that emerged first and foremost as a relationship between Russia and Ukraine. And I would build here a bridge to where we started, and this is the events of 1991. The Ukrainian referendum in December of 1991 really precipitated the fall of the Soviet Union, which was dissolved within 1 week after the referendum. And Ukraine, as the second largest Soviet republic after Russia, played that role because, again, Russia was not interested in the form of union without Ukraine, without the second largest part. Today, as we look at Russia reestablishing itself and its control over the post-Soviet space and beyond, the second largest piece of what was there in the 1991 becomes extremely important for the Russia's plans to reestablish itself in the post-Soviet space. When it comes to the West, my quite maybe controversial view is that the Cold War never ended in the post-Soviet space, because never there were agreements reached in the 1990s almost on every part of the world, but not on what will happen to the post-Soviet space. Russia, even before certainly Putin under Yeltsin, looked certainly at the post-Soviet space as a privileged Russian sphere of influence. And the West was treating after December of 1991, the declarations for independence of those countries as actually the countries were supposed to be independent and had the right to choose where they go. So that's, at least in my understanding, at least two major layers where that contributed to the current situation. Thank you.
Well, I would just add that I agree with most of what Serhiy said. There are two fundamental identities at play, and much of the contradiction is on the emotional level, that when Russians say, we love our Ukrainian brothers, many Ukrainians kind of cringe. Well, yeah, I guess because they don't want this love by imposition. What is extraordinary, again, is path dependency and psychology here, that for so many Russians, this is incomprehensible. This is totally incomprehensible. The idea is that the Russian identity must include Ukraine, must include Kyiv. Of course, is something that that helped Putin in the past to operate. However, I do think that the West played a role, because I did mention that originally American policymaking in this part of the world was much more cautious and driven by deep history and geopolitical realities and realization of risks. When I read the documents on the Bush administration, I could see that people like Baker, Scowcroft, not Cheney, but a few of them realized that if they treat Ukraine separately from Russia in any security and geopolitical setup, there would be war. I mean, in fact, Baker asked openly, Alexander Yakovlev, one of Gorbachev's ideological fellow, aren't you afraid of a war between Russia and Ukraine? And Yakovlev could not even understand what he was talking about. Baker totally understood how it could come up with. So, of course, it's in the land of fantasy, but let's suppose if some kind of setup as the Partnership of Peace could have been preserved for a decade, where Russia and Ukraine would have been treated on the same level, probably time would have helped. This time would have helped. However, the quick expansion of NATO into Eastern Europe and almost in parallel noises still very, very weak, but Russian intelligence picked them immediately, I guess, that Americans began to treat Ukraine separately from Russia as something that they would never allow Russia to claim and would always deny Russia as a geopolitical and a prize and so on and so forth. That did contribute to the ongoing feud among brothers, and added to geopolitical dimension and securitization of this problem, in my view.
Thank you so much to everyone. This has been a wonderful discussion. We have more questions in the Q&A, which all just speaks to the amount of wonderful information that's been disseminated here, the questions that have been inspired. I couldn't leave this without noting one question that brought in the figure of Gorbachev, who we never even got to, which is fascinating. So I think we should have a part two. But for this evening, we have to draw it to a close. So I thank you all so much for your participation. Thank you so much.